The Bob Murphy Show, episode 315.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. This episode is going to be a double dip, as it were, but I think you're going to like it. I recently gave three talks at Oklahoma State University. They had me out there. I was sponsored by their Free Enterprise Society for two of the lectures. And then once I was there, they had me give a talk to an entrepreneurship class. So each of those three lectures is ending up as a double dip on the three podcasts that I host. And so here for the Bob Murphy Show, the one that I did, here's the title of it: Caesar's Realm, God's Kingdom, Anarchism is a Biblical Response to Earthly Power. So this, I gave it on Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, if you're listening to this later in the future. The idea was, my first talk, I made the case for private law and private defense. And so that ended up, by the way, as an episode of the Human Action podcast that I host. And then I came back the next night in the same venue, same like sort of lecture series, to talk about this topic. And the idea is, okay, given that I have those unorthodox views when it comes to the existence of the state, how then do I reconcile that with my biblical Christianity? Because prima facie, that seems like they don't go together. And so that's what I am addressing in this talk. It does overlap somewhat with some of the things that you folks who listen to this podcast may have heard me say elsewhere or on this podcast itself, but there was some new material in here. Okay, specifically the last third, for sure, I go through a bunch of different Bible passages, some, you know, famous events in the Bible, and talk about their relevance or lack thereof to political anarchism. Okay, so with that set up, here we go. Hope you like it.
All right, well, thanks, Ryan and Steve, for the introduction, and thank you all. At this point, I'm seeing several of you now for the third time, so glad to see you again. As the talk suggests, I'm going to be here combining like two areas. So professionally, I have been an academic economist for, at this point, what, 24 years, something like that. And I've been very big in the political libertarian wing of that movement as an economist, writing a lot of free market solutions to social problems. Hey, how could the government privatize certain things? You know, that sort of idea. And then also, as I'll allude to a little bit here, in grad school, I became a Christian, and, you know, that's also a part of my life. And so a big issue has been, you know, are those things compatible, right? So I've talked a lot on this subject, like in various podcast formats and things like that, but I think this might be either the first or at most the second talk like this that I've given. So there's lots of ways I was trying to scope out, you know, for this title. So I'm going to go for an hour here, and then we'll save about 15 minutes at the end for your questions. So clearly this is a big topic, and I have to just pick and choose. So let's get right into it. Okay, first of all, let's clarify some terminology. So in this talk, when I say anarchist, strictly speaking, it's a type of anarchism that in the literature is referred to as anarcho-capitalism. The idea being, it's people who believe in a market economy and privatization, but they take it to the extreme. Okay, so you're probably familiar with, you know, somebody who might be in favor of, hey, I don't think there should be so-called public schools. I think education should be handled in the private sector. And so they don't want the government involved in schools. And you can say, okay, but there's pros and cons, and you can, you know, debate over that. It seems reasonable. Someone might even want to privatize the roads. You might think, well, gee, how would that work? But okay, there's pros and cons. But there's a group that they want to privatize even police services and military defense. So if you saw my talk last night, that's what that was all about. Like, how could that work? And so that those people, they refer to themselves as anarcho-capitalists. And the reason they put the capitalist on there is to distinguish themselves from, there's like anarcho-socialists, or historically people might have just referred to themselves as anarchists, but they were, you know, either outright Marxist or some other type of version of communist or socialist more generally, because they thought private property was, you know, a hierarchical structure that the capitalists were in bed with the government. And like, to, in order to have factory owners and big banks and stuff like that, you had to have the violent state there to enforce those rules. And in a more free, open society with no rulers, with no state apparatus, you would have socialism. That's how those people thought. So that's not the tradition I'm coming out of. That would be anarcho-socialist. This is anarcho-capitalism. Another term that gets thrown around a lot in this literature and this movement that I'm in is libertarian. So here, there's different types of ways of defining it, but a lot of people, they subscribe to that. What does it mean to be libertarian with a small L, not the party, but like the philosophy or the ethical framework? And so it's somebody who endorses what's called the non-aggression principle, or it's sometimes abbreviated the NAP. And that says it is immoral to initiate aggression against someone else. Okay, so it's not pacifism. It's not saying you're not allowed to use violence, but you can't use it. You can't have the initiation of that. So if someone's breaking into your house, a standard libertarian says you have the right to, you know, shoot the guy ultimately. But the point is, you obviously can't go break into someone else's house. But then also there's implications of this that, for example, something like drug legalization, a standard libertarian position on that, again, small L, not talking about the party per se, is to say, yeah, as a general rule, the government shouldn't punish somebody for selling heroin, certainly not to an adult, because, hey, someone taking heroin, you can say that's immoral. You can say it's unethical. You can say you're a bad, you know, father or husband or something if you're addicted to heroin. But that shouldn't be illegal because you're not violating anybody's rights. You're not initiating aggression against somebody. And so, therefore, if you believe in the NAP, it would be also immoral for the rest of society to say to you, we're going to throw you in a cage if we catch you doing that. Okay, because there you'd be initiating aggression again, right? So that's how that works, and you can see how a lot of standard libertarian policy views flow out of that principle. And so to connect it with the anarchism, the anarcho-capitalists say, hey, we're libertarians, we're just consistent about it. Or there's a joke that says, what's the difference between a libertarian and an ANCAP? About 6 months, right? That's the joke. Okay, so the idea being, once you accept libertarianism and the non-aggression principle, and you see how, oh yeah, the government shouldn't be throwing people in jail for using heroin, then it starts to say, well, does taxation make sense, right? Because isn't that, you know, if there's a law, but otherwise law-abiding person, that even the government stipulates, this person hasn't broken any rules, they're not bank robbers, they haven't mugged anybody, they're not, you know, they're not a rapist, they're not a murderer, it's just, oh, April 15th came and went, and they didn't send in their tax due, that they're, you know, the idea from an ANCAP perspective flowing out of libertarianism is to say, well, if they didn't violate anybody's rights, how can you just say you owe us a bunch of money or else we throw you in jail, right? So that's the idea. So anarcho-capitalists think that's the logical extension of the non-aggression principle. Okay, so having said all that, you might be surprised then to learn that I don't anymore, and I came to this view, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I stopped referring to myself as an anarchist, whereas before I had no problem saying that, and it was a twofold reason. So on the one hand, it was just there was a lot of baggage associated with the term, and so a lot of people thought, and I'll get to this in a minute, historically, like I said, there's been different ways that the word has been used, and it was just I would spend too much time trying to clarify, so I stopped leading with that. But then also I thought there was a more substantive issue that when I became a Christian, I said, well, isn't there a sense in which I'm a monarchist, right? Because, you know, Jesus is the King of Kings. And so there is a sense in which I believe in a monarchy. It's just I don't believe in a human should fill that role. And so that's another reason, like I said, more substantively, that I stopped volunteering. But if I'm at like a conference with a bunch of libertarians and someone comes up and says, hey, Dr. Murphy, are you an anarchist? I'll say yes, because I know what they mean. They're trying to say, are you merely a minarchist who believes in a night watchman state? Or do you go for the full Monty and think, no, get rid of the state altogether? That's what they're asking me. And so that's why I would just say, yes, I'm an anarchist, because I know that's what they mean. But like on my Twitter bio or something, I don't call myself an anarchist. Okay, the last sort of terminological clarification here, and then we'll get into more substantive things, is people in this sort of conversation a lot of times will say, they'll say, oh yeah, I don't like the government, or I want to get rid of the government with a small g, and other people will complain about that, and they'll say, no, like when they know what my view is, they'll say, Bob, you're not against the government. That broadly construed, if government just means like there's authority figures and they issue rulings, and then there are people that subscribe to that, you know, jurisdiction and abide by those rulings, that's a government. And so they might say the family is a, you know, the household family unit is a government, and the parents are in charge. And, you know, maybe some people, especially if they have a biblical framework, but they might even say the husband is the leader of the family and so forth. Okay. Or if you go to a certain type of church, there might be church elders, and maybe some guy in the congregation is cheating on his wife and everybody knows it. And the elders pull him aside and say, you know, you got to stop doing that. And he says, mind your own business. We're in love. And it just keeps going. And eventually they kick him out of the church. Okay. So a lot of people would have no problem referring to that as, oh yeah, there's a government of the church. So I'm okay with those social structures. And so, it may, just so you guys know where I'm coming from in this talk, it may be helpful for me to clarify and say, the sense in which I'm an anarchist and for anarchy means I don't agree with a political state with a capital S. Whereas if government just means like what I said, then yes, I'm okay with the existence of government in that sense. But also, you guys get what I mean, that if somebody says like, oh yeah, I don't like the government, they're not talking about their church. They're not talking about their parents. They mean the institution that fines me on April 15th, or if I drive too fast, pulls me over and says that, you know, go take this breathalyzer or whatever. You get what I'm saying, right? Or that ultimately can draft me and send me to war. That's who you mean colloquially when you say the government. Okay. There's also, as I say, so in this discussion, just to be, again, clear where I'm coming from, there's two types of anarchists. So one is, again, the historical, I don't know if you can read it, but that's a political cartoon, in that it says European anarchist here. I think this is probably like an old-timey cartoon. I just got this from Google. And it says, come unto me, oppressed. Right? And so it's obviously some American, probably like what we'd call a nativist, who was against unrestricted immigration at the time, whenever this was written or drawn, and saying, we've got to watch out for those European anarchists. And so they're, you know, the cliche or the stereotype is the bomb-throwing anarchists. And there really were people like that, right? So that people didn't invent that. There really were self-described anarchists who were, you know, engaged in what we would call political terrorism, including bomb-throwing. And that made sense, right? They didn't believe in the state. And so what do? If you think some violent institutions causing war and mass oppression and poverty and starvation, you know, get rid of it. So let's make some bombs, right? That's obviously not what I am endorsing in this talk. Another way, though, of seeing it more colloquially and nowadays is even among self-described anarcho-capitalists, there is a certain type of person who's attracted to that philosophy because they think, I don't want anyone imposing their rules on me. They don't believe in authority per se. And a lot of times these people are atheists, right, which, you know, that kind of makes sense psychologically. If you're an atheist, then you're probably more likely to be someone who thinks, I don't want some external authority figure imposing their rules of conduct on me. I'm my own person. I'm self-sovereign. So there are a lot of people like that who are attracted to libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism more specifically. And so that's why they like it, because they don't think rules should apply to them. And there's no authority figure higher than me, is the mentality. And so that's why they're attracted to the movement. There's plenty of people like that among the ranks of modern self-described anarcho-capitalists. But there's another strand. So this is Murray Rothbard, in case you don't know. So he was one of the leading theorists in the modern anarcho-capitalist tradition. He was an economist, was his, you know, training, but he wrote a lot on political philosophy. So where Rothbard, by the way, also was technically an atheist, but a lot of his associates were Catholic primarily, and Rothbard had a lot of respect for like the natural law tradition, you know, through the works of like Aquinas and things like that, and the early church fathers. And so Rothbard respected the church as an institution, the Catholic Church as an institution that was sort of like a bulwark against the state. And again, liked the natural law tradition coming out of that framework. And so somebody like Rothbard, the reason he was an anarchist wasn't because he didn't think, there shouldn't be rules applying to anybody and how dare the state try to impose rules on people. That's not where he was coming from. He was coming from the other way, saying no one is above the law, including politicians and soldiers and judges and police and people working for the IRS. And so the way Rothbard viewed it, the reason he was against the things that the modern state, again with a capital S, does is because he said those are things that are inherently immoral. If we in our private lives did a lot of the things that people think are the purview of the state, it would clearly be a crime. So, like, you know, what's the military draft? That's slavery. You grab a bunch of people, say, you're going to go do some work for us, which involves things that you might think are horribly immoral. Go kill some people over there. And if you don't, we're going to throw you in a cage or shoot you or whatever for desertion, right? So that's clearly private individuals can't act like that. What is taxation? Many of you may have seen the memes going around saying taxation is theft. So again, regardless of what you think is done with the money and the benefits of that, the idea is no. In my private capacity, if a bunch of neighbors and I come together and say, hey, we think everybody should chip in $100 a month to have a soup kitchen, and some crotchety old guy down the street says, no, I don't want to, we can't just go and take it out of his bank account and say it's for a good cause. That's theft. You can't do that. You have to convince people. And if you take their money against their will, that's theft. You can't do it. But yet, isn't that the essence of taxation? And it doesn't, you know, and again, in a private setting, it doesn't change things if just a majority votes for it. Okay, so that's kind of the argument. Or something like jury duty. Isn't that also forced labor? All right, so all kinds of things that the government, the state does all the time. Rothbard's point is the only reason they get away with that is because we have this weird thing in our conventional value system where stuff that would be wrong for us to do, it's okay for agents of the state to do it. So again, so he's coming at it not saying, I'm an anarchist because no rules. He's saying, no, because I believe in these rules, that's why I think they should apply to everybody, that nobody is above the law. Okay, so you can see both types of people and personality types and like ethical views are attracted to the libertarian movement in the United States. So, you know, that's where I'm most familiar with it. And like I say, I can talk to these people, I can tell that even though they all like the writings of Murray Rothbard, their ultimate motivations are actually pretty far apart in terms of where they're coming from. Okay. So it's just real quickly, I'll give you a short version of my own views, not because it's particularly relevant to this talk, but again, just so you can more understand where I'm coming from, particularly for those of you who are yourselves religious. Just this might help you understand, you know, some of the stuff I say later. You might be able to, you know, put me into a box if that helps you just categorize where I'm coming from. Okay, so I was raised, that's not a picture of me, that's off Google. I was raised Catholic, and if you're familiar with the Catholic Church and the sacrament, I got confirmed. Okay, if you're familiar with that, that's the extent that I went through. And then in high school, and particularly going into undergrad, also not a picture of me, that's Richard Feynman. He's a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He wrote a couple of pop books, real funny guy, you know, brilliant physicist, but also very irreverent about religious topics, you know, didn't believe in God, thought that stuff was superstitious. So he was kind of my idol, like in junior high, and I wanted to become a physicist and grow up and be like him. And so that's where I abandoned my childhood traditions and faith and became, and I called myself a devout atheist. I thought that was very clever. And in fact, in undergrad, I started doing research to write the definitive refutation of Christianity. Okay, so just so you know where I was coming from at that point, because I had read some stuff on atheism and thought, like, H.L. Mencken has a book called A Treatise on the Gods. And there was a guy, George Smith, a libertarian, who had a book called, I think it was just called Atheism. And just to give you a flavor, so Smith would say things like, he would make arguments appealing to libertarians saying, "It's I don't believe in the existence of the God of the Bible, but isn't that a good thing? Because there's no worse tyrant who's ever been imagined in fiction than the God of the Old Testament, right? And even in the New Testament version where he's, kinder and gentler still, the basic Christian doctrine is, hey, I created everything and you better love me or you're going to roast in hell forever. And gee, aren't you glad that being doesn't exist, right? That's kind of arguments he was given, okay? So I understood that. I liked where they were coming from, but I thought I can take it deeper. And I was going to, Thomas Paine, who I loved, for political reasons. You may know him, that he wrote a lot of real stirring stuff in the Revolutionary War. Like Washington would have his men, like the captains, read Thomas Paine's writings to get the troops all riled up and ready to fight. He also wrote a book called The Age of Reason, where he went through and tried to systematically. So Paine wasn't an atheist. He was a deist, but he didn't believe in Christianity. He thought Christianity was an abomination that was like sacrilegious towards the true God, which was, this disembodied force that created things at the beginning and just kind of set the clockwork in motion. All right. And so he went through and tried to point out contradictions in the gospel accounts and stuff like that. All right. So I thought, I like what you guys have all done, and I was going to write a definitive refutation. That's where I was as of undergrad. And then we don't have time for story now. And again, I want to focus on more substantive things besides my personal odyssey. But in grad school, I had a lot of stuff that happened. I ended up accepting Jesus, and I now refer to myself as a Bible-believing Christian. So some of my, one of my heroes or guys I look to as a spiritual guide is R.C. Sproul, the guy on top. Like, I love going and listening to his lectures and or sermons on various topics. I don't agree with everything he says, but I agree with most of what he says. So if you know him, that's partly where I'm coming from. And then this is actually Luis Molina, who was a member of the School of Salamanca. And so I knew him back when I was an atheist. He's one of the early contributors to economic science. Back then there wasn't a distinct field of economics, just learned men would write on all kinds of stuff. And so he wrote a bunch of stuff on that we would now say, oh, that's a precursor of Austrian economics. So that's how I knew of him. But he also wrote on theological matters and has a very interesting way of trying to reconcile God's sovereignty with human free will. Okay. So, and I had been grappling with that question philosophically, and I did some podcast episodes on it, and some people emailed me and said, it looks like you kind of reinvented Molinism. Go check out. And it turned out they were right, that I had stumbled upon a framework that this guy. So if you know that stuff, listen, that's where I'm coming from. I've seen the Q&A. If you want to pursue this, feel free. Okay. Another sort of, warning or disclaimer with this stuff is I try to personally be very, very careful in not allowing my political ideological views to color my interpretation of the Bible, let's say. And so this is something that C.S. Lewis warned about. So the point of mere Christianity, in the beginning, if you're reading it, to understand, like, why is he titling that? Was he talking? Because he was saying, I am a mere Christian, meaning Lewis at the time he wrote this was lamenting the fact that there were a lot of political movements that the people would try to append it to Christianity, like to say, oh, you should, if you're a Christian, you should be a pacifist. If the people were against entry into the Second World War, stuff like that. Or if you're a Christian, you should be a socialist, and that's why you should support redistribution programs to feed the poor. If you're a good Christian, and so there are a lot of political activists who were wearing their Christianity on their sleeve as a way of bolstering support for their pet cause. And obviously Lewis's point is, no, if you're a Christian, Jesus is your Lord, and that's really who you are. So one way I sort of tease some of my colleagues, if people call themselves a Christian libertarian, I'll say, well, shouldn't you call yourself a libertarian Christian? You get what I'm saying there? Okay. So anyway, that's just, again, with this talk, I get sometimes I'm almost a bit squeamish, like mixing these things together. But on the other hand, I am, a member of both camps. the libertarian anarcho-capitalists and Christians, and a lot of people think that they're contradictory, and so that's what I'm going to now do in the remaining time here is try to explain to you why I don't think they're actually contradictory.
Okay, so here, I promise, for those of you who saw my talk last night, there's only going to be two slides here that are repetition from last night and starting right now, but I have to go through this just for people who only showed up to this one, just so you kind of know where I'm coming from and how I'm going to try, what it is I'm trying to reconcile with Christianity. Okay, so the big thing in terms of anarcho-capitalism and my views on this stuff are, how could you have market-based a court system and police ruling or police and law enforcement, stuff like that? And so this is the framework of the system. There's a dispute. Instead of picking up the phone and calling the cops, there's no such, you know, organization. There's this entity. What do? If they can't work it out themselves, they take their dispute to a third party. And so the essential element of that process is both people agree on the front end to submit their dispute to the discretion or the opinion of this third party. And the only way that can work is if there's a group of arbitrators who have a reputation for fairness and integrity. Otherwise, they wouldn't get business because both parties have to agree ahead of time. Yeah, I think this guy's got a reputation for fairness. I think I'm in the right in this dispute. Yeah, I'm willing to submit our case to this guy. Right. So that's how the basic framework. And again, in this system, it's not that the judge has some authority over you and is issuing an edict. It's they're literally just rendering an opinion and say, this is the body of law, or even more in a more decentralized fashion, there's competing law codes floating around, and the people in a dispute specify ahead of time, we agree, we want our disagreement to be settled according to this type of rule book. And then you're the judge applying these rules to our particular situation here, because the rules are sort of general and abstract. Real world cases are very messy. And so it takes a judge who's an expert in that rule system to apply it in this case. All right. And so, you know, there doesn't need to be one rule book for everybody in a certain geographical region. The idea is people can have different ones that they subscribe to. And as long as everybody in a particular dispute can agree on a particular code that's going to be used to settle it, that's all you need. It doesn't need to be the same code for every single dispute. Why would you need that? You don't need that. As long as everybody can resolve their disputes this way, that's conducive to a functioning, peaceful society. All right. So that's kind of my vision of how this would happen in practice if you didn't have a monopoly state in charge of the courts and the law and the, you know, having a police agency that enforces all that stuff. Okay. And then a point that I walked through more carefully last night was to say, in this system, even though, especially if you're new and you're just hearing me for the first time today, that might sound like, whoa, it sounds like there'd be all kinds of different rules floating around. I think in practice, there actually would be a systematic rule of law in a region that obeyed these principles even more than there is right now in the world dominated by states. That right now, if you commit a certain type of crime in Alabama versus California, there might be different penalties that you know happen based on where you are located. So it's not that there's the same rules applicable in the U.S., and certainly if you cross into Mexico or Canada, the rules are a lot different, even more so, right? So yet most people who think you need a state to provide law and order, they don't think we need one world government, right? And so it's interesting. So well, why not? If you're okay with there being a different government system and different rules in the U.S., 50 U.S. states, and certainly going from the U.S. to Germany, if you're okay with that and you don't think that that's going to be just pure anarchy, well then, you know, what's a problem with this kind of system? Okay, so anyway, that's kind of the framework where I'm coming from. And then one last component of it, and then we'll jump into the, you know, how do you reconcile this with standard Christianity? The question, okay, in the kind of framework I just walked through, would there be, you know, so I've told you kind of what the free market, private sector analog of judges would be. I skipped over some of this discussion here, but what would be the free market voluntary analog of law enforcement or police? I think there'd be competing companies. I don't think they would be heavily armed. I think they would, in most cases, try to apprehend suspects without hurting anybody. I don't think you'd see high-speed car chases. Like, you know, there's some crazy videos floating around now on, you know, Twitter or Facebook that some guy does something, you know, robs a bank, let's say, and there's 15 police cars chasing him on the interstate, and he's doing it, and the police end up, you know, hitting some, this recently happened, like smashed in or hit a car, and then that car went spinning, and some lady was crossing the street with a baby stroller, right? I'll stop telling you what happened, but it wasn't pretty. Okay, so lots of stuff like that. I don't think that would happen in this kind of a system. That wouldn't be good for business, right? Somebody robbed a bank. I think they'd have mechanisms in place where they could trace that stuff better and just isolate the person, have private detectives figure out who it is, and there'll be other mechanisms in place to try to, you know, use boycotts and whatever to isolate them as opposed to high-speed car chases that end up killing pedestrians. That's crazy. Okay, so anyway, that's kind of the framework. But then for this slide, you say, all right, I guess I can see how that might work. I understand where you're coming from, Murphy, but what about prisons? Would there be some voluntary analog of a prison? So the way I think this kind of thing would be handled, and again, I'm just walking through this to then say this kind of a system, how would that fare vis-a-vis standard Christian doctrines? I think, yeah, there might be things that we, with our vantage point, if you were transported into a society that followed these principles or practices, we might look at that building and say, oh, that's a prison. That's what that is. But and so how it would arise is, I think, okay, so for one thing, every parcel of land in this kind of a society would have an owner, a private owner. Or it might be joint, like there might be a company that owns it, and then there's a bunch of shareholders who together own the company, that sort of thing. But there wouldn't be public property. The way right now, if you say who owns the sidewalks or who owns the main street or the interstate and things like that, people say the government does. And so you could say the taxpayers or the people collectively, but you get the idea. Whereas who owns a particular restaurant, you'd say, oh, that's Jim Smith owns that, or the, you know, such and such corporation owns that restaurant. And so in a privatized society, every bit of land, if there were sidewalks, the owners of particular stretches would all have an individual specific owner. And that person would have the legal right to set whatever rules they want on their property. And, you know, stuff like, is there smoking or not? You know, stuff like that. Can you have guns on the property? You know, all that kind of stuff would just be the owner can set the rules. And then I think it'd be pretty standard that one of the rules would be, if you're convicted in a reputable court, you know, meaning that people brought evidence before a reputable judge who's got, a track record of fairness and competence and these types of rulings, and has a lot of experience, and somebody brings a bunch of evidence saying, we think this guy's a serial killer. You know, there's been a bunch of bodies turning up, and we have evidence pointing to this guy being the killer in at least three of the cases. It's pretty open and shut, and the guy's on the run, and, you know, he gets notified, hey, we're going to try your case. Do you want to show up? Do you want to get a lawyer? And he says, no, you're all a bunch of crooks. I didn't do anything. Okay, and he gets convicted in absentia, is what the term would be. So the community is now put on alert. Hey, this guy walking around, we think he's a serial killer. So we don't have to go through, and a lot of libertarian, you know, treatises go through like the wrestling with, gee, can we just drive up and grab that guy and throw him in a cage? And, you know, because libertarians, they want to be concerned with the ethical use of violence or force against people. So they spend a lot of time. And so my take is, I think we can sidestep that. It doesn't matter. We don't need to wrestle with the question, are you allowed to grab a convicted criminal and put him against his will into the back of a paddy wagon and drive down and throw him in a cage? That doesn't matter, because everybody in the area who knows this is a convicted serial killer can just say, you can't stand on my property, get off. But if everybody in the whole area says that, he has nowhere to stand. Okay, so make sure you follow my argument. Clearly, it's within your rights as a property owner to say, if I don't want you on my land, you have to get out, right? If you're not seeing it, just imagine your own house, right? Clearly, if someone wants to come in and sit down at your dinner table, you can say, no, get out. And it's not your job to say why. If they say, what did I do? You can just say, I don't want you in my house, get out, right? And that's pretty, most people agree right now in the real world, you have the right to do that legally. And so I'm saying, okay, just extend that. If every bit of land is owned by somebody in this kind of a framework, you have the right to say who can be on your land or not. And I think pretty clearly
most people in the community, if a guy's literally a convicted serial killer, say, you can't stay here. Okay, but if everybody's doing that, he's a pariah, where's he going to go? And so I think there would be a role for institutions that would arise that would say, if you're a pariah that no one else wants you, you can come stay here. And they might be either motivated by, altruistic religious reasons, maybe like a home for wayward people. And, we know that God forgives everybody. Saul was a murderer and God used him. And so we don't condemn you. We're sinners as well. Come here and we'll work with you, whatever. Or it could be a for-profit institution that just says, hey, we know no one else wants to house you. You come here. We're going to have rules. When you first get in here, we're going to have like a containment room and we're going to have metal detectors and we're going to, give you a jumpsuit and whatever, loose-fitting clothes so that we make sure you're not sneaking weapons and hurting our personnel. But you can stay here. We'll feed you, give you a decent room, give you a workstation, but we're going to charge you room and board. Okay, and that's why they're doing it, because they make money off it. And if the person can work, either doing something internally, like if they can come up with things for the person to do, or if they just can use the internet. Like nowadays, it's a lot of people can earn a living just, having a workstation and internet access. If they can do that, maybe the guy, the example I used last week, some guy, maybe he's an architect and he's really talented, but he gets anger issues. And if he drinks too much, he gets in bar fights and maybe he killed somebody. Okay, so that kind of a person, they say, all right, you can work here and then pay us whatever, $5,000 a month, but obviously, we're not going to give you a bunch of Jack Daniels all the time too, because then you get violent. Okay, so there could be rules like that, and they can't leave. That's stipulation. So it's like a hotel, but the Hotel California. Okay, so those would be, I think, the free market analog of what we now refer to as prisons, but I think they would be much more humane than the current system. So for one thing, these things would be competing with each other for the business of pariahs. So the pariahs on the front end could choose which of these institutions do I want to go to. And so certainly if one of them was known to have sadistic guards, people aren't going to want to go to that one. They're going to go to a different one. Okay. So in all of them, it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be literally like a hotel. You're going to get padded down. You're going to have very restricted privileges in terms of what you can do, but you're not going to get beaten up by guards, and other residents aren't going to do other horrible things that we all know happen in the current system. That wouldn't happen here, because again, if it did happen in one of them, people would know about that eventually and they wouldn't choose to go there. Okay, so that's kind of the framework I'm just reviewing from last night for those who saw that talk. So now let's jump into, okay, what that framework, given now that that's my vision of what an anarchist free market society might look like, as a Christian, what should we think about that? Okay, one last distinction I should make is, just like I said, there's different types of people who are attracted to libertarianism. There's also, even like more at an institutional level, differences in the movement. So here, I'm brushing with a broad stroke here, okay, that not everyone associated with reason is like, so here, let me just back up. The distinction I am making is somebody could think it's illegitimate for the government to interfere with prostitution or the drug trade because that's just a violation of natural rights and the government has no authority to do that. But they could still say, I think it's immoral, or I think it's a sin, if you're a religious person and the word sin means something to you. And I'm certainly going to teach my kids not to do that. And if they do that when they're still living under my house, under my roof, they're in big trouble. If I catch them, smoking marijuana or drinking alcohol or whatever, right? And engaging in premarital sex, you could have all those rules, but they don't think it's legitimate for the government to put grown people in jail for soliciting the services of a prostitute or dealing cocaine. Okay, so that's one type of person and their arguments. Another type, though, is to say, what's the big deal? Like, history is full of repressive societies, and if we just had people, freely experimenting with drugs and free love and this and that, and don't you think by maybe making people feel ashamed of their sexuality that causes all kinds of bad social, right? So that's another type of person who is attracted to the libertarian political philosophy and might endorse it because that's where they're coming from, okay?
And so both groups are in the modern libertarian movement. And then, like I say, the different organizations catering to them institutionally, you can see those differences. So here I'm just saying colloquially, the reason, if you know them, tend to be more towards the, hey, let's not judge people, man. Everyone gets along. As long as you're not physically hurting somebody, I don't care what you do. Whereas the Mises Institute tends to be associated with the scholars and then the type of fan base they have tend to be more religious. And the reason they're against the state is that's a usurpation of God's, you know, prerogatives or what have you. Okay. So that's, again, there are religious people affiliated with reason and there are atheists who are fans of the Mises Institute. I'm not saying it's a perfect correlation, but I am just saying there is that distinction. Okay. Oops. Okay, so now let's jump into some relevant Bible passages here. We'll go through these, and then, like I say, I'll turn over to your guys' questions to walk through the a lot of Bible passages for a Bible-believing Christian that on the surface may seem to conflict with or at least cause tension with the kind of vision that I just painted. And so somebody, you know, this isn't hypothetical. I've had plenty of Christians say to me, you know, with all due respect, how can you be a Christian given your political, or rather, how can you embrace those political views if you're a Christian? That's usually the way they'll phrase it. They don't want me to stop being a Christian. They want me to stop being an anarcho-capitalist. Okay, so a popular one is the very last verse in the book of Judges. So the history here was the Israelites for a period were ruled by what were called judges, and they were, you know, you could say it was like a theocracy, where, you know, Moses had come down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and then other elements of the law is spelled out in, like, you know, Deuteronomy and Leviticus, and the judges would enforce that. And so if the children of Israel had a dispute that they couldn't work out, ultimately they would go to the judges, who were then supposed to be the authoritative figures giving pronouncements on here's what the Mosaic law says on this dispute, okay? And the way that book ends is this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And so I have had Bible-believing Christians say to me, well, isn't your framework that? And isn't the Bible pretty clearly, like, the Bible's not saying that like, that's a cool thing. They're saying this was a bad situation. Right? If you read it in context, that's clearly what the point is there to say that's not good, that everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Okay, so my response to that is to say, yes, I agree. Everyone doing what was right in his own eyes, it was condemning that, lamenting that. But from the first part there, it wasn't saying, too bad Israel didn't have a king, right? And that's pretty clear for those of you who know where I'm going with this. It's going to be obvious what I'm going to do, because after, you know, there's one book in between and then it gets into the book of Samuel. It says, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Okay, so again, what's happening here is how Israel comes to have an earthly king is the people demand it. Okay, so again, the backstory for the, they were slaves in Egypt, and then Moses famously, you know, says to the Pharaoh, let my people go. Pharaoh doesn't do it. And then there's a bunch of plagues. And finally, the Pharaoh says, yeah, get out of here. Moses leads them out. And then ultimately, you know, they end up and they're being ruled internally by the judge system. But ultimately, they want to get a king. Okay. And so here's where that comes from. And the children of Israel are asking. So Samuel being the prophet who's like the direct intermediary between the people and God at this point in their history, say, give us a king like the other nations. So they're looking around at all the pagans. And they all have kings, and we don't, and we want to be like them. And so that's what they're asking for. And so one thing, in fairness to the children of Israel, because this is often used, you know, like if a preacher on Sunday gets up and starts talking about this, the point's going to be to bash the people of Israel, and they didn't trust God. But I do want to point out, that gives some context here, that Samuel, you know, he was getting ready to kind of hand the reins over. He had appointed his children as the judges, and the Bible, it says it more explicitly before this part that I'm not showing you. The Bible clearly says his sons did not walk in his ways, right? They were corrupt.
So they were corrupt judges. So we shouldn't be too harsh with the children. The reason they didn't like this system with the judges is the judges were corrupt and they weren't doing what they were supposed to. So because they realized, gee, the status quo is pretty bad, they're looking around and, well, the other nations have kings. Maybe that's what we should do. So that's what they're asking. And then it's pretty clear. So Samuel goes to God, says, hey, the people are asking me for a king. What should I tell them? And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Now, therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. Okay, so this is a classic example where God's letting people make a poor choice just to, like, you know, see the consequences. Like, okay, I'm not going to fight you if you want to choose this. I'm going to tell you why what you're about to do is a mistake, but I'm not going to stop you. You want a king? Here's a king. I'll give you a king good and hard. Okay, so I'm just saying tied into the last verse from Judges where they said there was no king and everyone did what was right in his eyes. Clearly, the takeaway from that is not, see, you need to have an earthly leader of your political system or else everyone's just running off and doing whatever they think is right, and clearly that's anarchy and chaos. That's not what the message was, okay? Because here, when they say, therefore, the solution to this untenable arrangement where everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes and the judges are corrupt is let's have a king. God is clearly, he's going to let them do it, but his point is you're going to be sorry. And notice he said, you're rejecting me. So the point was, yeah, they were supposed to have a king. It was supposed to be God. And they're saying, that's not good enough. We want a human to fulfill that role. And God is saying, okay, they're rejecting me. And then just continuing with that. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Okay, so this is pretty crystal clear. He's saying, yeah, I'll give you a king and look at everything that comes with that bargain. And you're going to regret that. But here, go ahead and do it and see what happens. And when you end up complaining about it because he's going to oppress you, you know, I'm not going to be there wiping your tears away at that point. Okay, at the end of the world, he will, but not yet. Okay, so that's pretty crystal clear what God feels about the institution of an earthly system, at least for these people, right? So obviously, Bible-believing Christians who are not anarcho-capitalists are aware of this, right? So I'm not trying to say, oh, there you have it, folks, and anyone who disagrees with me must not know their Bible. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm just trying to show you why I think I'm being consistent in my views too. Okay, let's jump ahead to the New Testament. So here's a real famous one, and a lot of people take this famous Bible story to mean that clearly modern Christians should be okay with the, you know, is the title of the talk, you know, Caesar versus God. I think that's partly why we chose that title, because that clearly crystallizes this issue, this dilemma, this tension, let's say. So a lot of people in this story I'm about to go over with you think this clearly shows that Jesus is endorsing the fact, yeah, maybe in the Old Testament God said don't have a king, but given we are where we are as of the time we're talking, you know, as Jesus walked the earth as a man, clearly the argument goes is this story is going to show us Jesus was okay with the existence of an earthly political institution with, you know, human heads of state, and he just thought, you know, keep them in their own realm, and then, you know, godly things are in their realm. So, okay. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk, and they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. Okay, so for those, I'm sure a lot of you are here because you are a Christian, but they're hypocrites. They're just buttering him. They don't believe this stuff, okay? They're flattering him because they're hypocrites, right? Because they're trying to trap him, and I'll explain what the trap is in case you haven't heard someone spell this out before. So the question they have after they give this false obeisance to him
is to say, tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Okay, so this is a great example of why, you know, I personally think this is clearly the Son of God, the way he gets out of this trap. So here's how the trap works. They don't care what his answer is. They have plotted ahead of time thinking, so because the context, he's going around performing miracles and he's making, you know, giving amazing sermons and seems to have a command of the Mosaic law and the, you know, the rabbinical teachings and whatnot. And he's speaking with authority. And so he's a threat to the religious authorities of his day. And the people are starting to really think, could this be the Messiah that we've been waiting for? Because, you know, he's healing people all over the place. So these people want to put a stop to this because he's threatening, you know, they got a good system going. And so they think this is going to trap him because they're asking. So remember, right now, like, Israel is under the Roman Empire. Okay, so the Romans are in charge, but the way the Romans worked, they would conquer a region, and then they would kind of let the local people still maintain nominal control, but they had to pay, you know, allegiance to Caesar back in Rome. Okay, so that's kind of, it was like a decentralized federal system with our terminology. That's how they did it. So the local Jewish religious authorities still, you know, had their prerequisites and prerogatives and so forth, but, you know, people had to pay taxes to Caesar. And so they think they're going to catch Jesus in a trap here, because if he says, yes, it is lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, then the people who were hoping he was going to be the Messiah, and they thought the Messiah was going to be a revolutionary leader. They thought he was going to be from, you know, the house of David, and he was going to rise up and overthrow these Roman oppressors, liberate the people of Israel in a political sense, and then, you know, be their new king. You know, because isn't that what the prophets told us was going to happen, right? So they were familiar with the prophecies and they just misunderstood exactly what it meant. Okay, so that's what they were hoping for. And so the point is, if he says yes, well, then he's a sellout. The people are going to abandon their faith in him if he says yes. So he can't say yes. But what if he says no? If he says no, then we're going to go and tattle on him to the Romans and say, hey, there's this upstart, up-and-coming religious leader walking around, this guy Jesus, we think he's from Nazareth, and he just openly, we opened him in public. We got a bunch of witnesses and we said, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And he said, no. So you better do something about this guy. Right? So that's what they thought. So again, they didn't care what his answer was. They just thought either way he's dead. And so what does he do in this situation? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. Right? So that was like a coin of the day. And he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. Okay, so the coin had Caesar, you know, just like our money has dead U.S. presidents on it, right? So the coin of the day had Caesar's image and, you know, language signifying it was a Roman coin. They said to him, Caesar's. And then he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And when they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Okay, so you see, that's how he got out of the trap, right? He didn't say yes, and he didn't say no, all right? And yet, he also didn't hem and haw. You get what I'm saying? Like, in other words, I should have said that before I went to this slide. He couldn't say no, he couldn't say yes, and he also couldn't dodge the question. If he just dodged the question, it would be apparent to the crowds, oh yeah, he's a chicken. He doesn't want to answer. Just like a politician now, if he gets asked an uncomfortable question, and they kind of hem and haw, and then they change the subject, and you know they're doing that. So they thought no matter what he does, and yet he goes through this. And so notice, just, you know, forget for the moment whether he's the Son of God or not. And just, this is a masterful response rhetorically. Because notice too, if he just jumped to that answer and just said, you know, if they said, is it lawful to pay the tax or not? If he merely had said, well, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and God what's God's, that might have worked, but it wouldn't have been as dramatic. Whereas when he does this buildup, where he doesn't answer him at first and just says, bring me the coin, whose inscription, whose image is that? And then he gives him that punchline. And that's why I said, you know, they marveled that they were, you know, you can imagine they probably literally took a step back. They didn't even know what to do with what he just said. Because if you just analyze it, you say, well, what did he mean? We're not sure. And it's possible he wasn't definitively saying one or the other. So what's interesting about this answer is it's definitely true. It's like a tautology. In other words, nobody can argue with that.
right? He said, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and give to God what's God's. That's clearly a true statement, right? But then when you say, okay, but is this Caesar's? And you say, you know, it was almost like a misdirection or like a magician's trick. He said, whose image is on there? So the conventional interpretation of this from a Christian who is okay with the existence of a political state is to say, yeah, Jesus is clearly saying, pay your taxes, be a good citizen, but also, you know, be a good Christian. And if there should ever be a direct conflict where, like, if the state orders you to do something, like if the state ordered you to worship the head of state as God, you clearly disobey that order, right? And there's stuff in the Bible where that happened and the people, you know, righteously refused to obey that order. But if the state says, pay 20% of your income, and you're like, oh, they wasted on those welfare bums. Most Christians would, R.C. Sproul says this, the guy that I said I liked, when he lectures on this, he says, yeah, unless it's a direct violation of, you know, Christian doctrine, you be a good citizen. And that's what this means. That's what Jesus is saying. But I want to say that's not obvious to me, that I think Jesus is more saying you need to decide in your life what area is going to be under God's authority and what area is going to be under the political rulers, and you live accordingly. And another element to this, and I have to move on here because there's other stuff I want to cover, I've seen people point out there might be something else going on here. When he said to them, bring me the coin, and then, you know, whose image is that? Da, 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 da. It wasn't merely that he was building up to dramatic effect the way, you know, I've talked about. It's also possible that he was pointing out, you guys are all walking around with Rome's coins in your pocket. You're using the money of the oppressors. And so maybe he was subtly showing the people that these guys who claim to be your leader and they're trying to, you know, zing me here with this trap, they're a bunch of hypocrites. You know, they're all walking around. They're collaborators with the oppressors. You know, so there might be an element, because there were multiple monies floating around, right? That's, if you remember, like Jesus overturning the table of the money changers, right? So the fact that they had these coins ready at their disposal could itself have been evidence that, yeah, these people are collaborators, right? So I'm not as sure about that element, but I have heard a lot of people, you know, make that point about this when they're trying to interpret it. Okay. But the very least, what I'm saying is, I hope I've shown this isn't a clear-cut slam dunk that, yep, Jesus said, go ahead and pay your taxes. Also, another reason, even taking R.C. Sproul's interpretation at face value, the stuff that the state does with my tax dollars right now, I think is quite clearly immoral according to Christian doctrine, right? Like, I think they do a lot of stuff overseas that's, you know, murder. Okay, so to be clear, I still pay my taxes. This is being recorded. I still pay my taxes, but I'm not lying. I do that, you know, but my point being, it's not merely that, oh, I don't want to give these bums my money and they waste it. Like, no, they do things that are, so yes, they're not asking me to, you know, endorse Satan, but they do a lot of stuff that I think is satanic with a small s, okay? So even if we do take R.C. Sproul's interpretation and say, just so long as the government's not directly violating, I say, well, I think actually it is, and many things that it does. Okay, so there's that. Okay, Matthew 17. This is a similar story, but the resolution different. And I don't see people talking about this a lot. And I always thought this was a fascinating one. When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the temple tax? And he said, yes. So it's a negative, a double negative. Peter means Jesus does pay the temple tax, just don't be confused. And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, what do you think, Simon? Simon and Peter are the same guy. From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes, from their sons or from strangers? And Peter said to him, from strangers. And Jesus said, then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you. Okay, so here, a lot going on with a lot of these stories. They seem very simple and straightforward, but when you analyze it, you can spend, you know, that's why Christian preachers get up and will spend a whole hour and a half talking about, you know, a story that's this long. So one thing here, of course, is that Peter is very headstrong. He's always shooting his mouth off and, you know, kind of digging himself into a thing where he confidently says something that ends up being wrong. So here, the point is, he should not have said that, right? When the people
kind of, you know, questioning this guy Jesus and grabbing one of his chief followers and saying, hey, does your teacher pay the temple tax? And Peter saying, yes, he probably should have checked with the boss before he answered on his behalf. Because Jesus is kind of saying to him, huh, that's interesting. And notice too, the rhetorical, he didn't just like smack him and say, what are you doing, Peter? Like he, you know, did a Socratic dialogue to try to get Peter to see why did you say that, Peter? Right? Because if Jesus is the Son of God and he's, you know, refers to his father, sent me here and so forth, then why would Jesus have to pay the tax to the temple? So that's what Jesus is getting at. But what's interesting is he doesn't just leave it up in the air the way he did before. The other story happens later in the chronology than this one, but I wanted to cover the other one first, right? So here, Jesus didn't say, okay, well, let the strangers pay the tax and let the sons not, and then walked away and let them figure. No, he said, we'll pay the tax. Okay, so you know, you see what I'm saying? There seems to be a thing here where Jesus is clearly okay with paying the tax to the temple. And in our terminology, we would say it wasn't really a tax, right? It's not you were going to go into a cage if you didn't do this. It was more a tithe or, you know, a donation that was due or a contribution to remain in good standing with the religious authorities. It wasn't the same thing as not paying the tax to Rome. Okay. And also the way they come up with it, he doesn't say, you know, guys, go paint a house and raise some money. And then he does a miracle. So again, I think that's interesting that even when he says, let's go pay the tax, the way they come up with the funds is somewhat miraculous. All right. So again, we won't get to dwell on that here, but I just want to point out there's a lot going on in this quick story. Okay. Matthew 5. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Okay, so to me, this pretty clearly lines up with the system that I described earlier when I just went through the quick demonstration of what I thought my society, you know, following those principles would look like. So I think, this is from the Sermon on the Mount, I think clearly if you had to contrast the two systems and about law enforcement, whatever, that this one is much more, like I think my system of law enforcement is much more Christian in this sense than the current punitive system. There's another quick element here too. The thing about whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him. I recently heard someone make the point. So think of it. So here's my right cheek. If someone slaps me, if they're, you know, most people are right-handed. So to hit me here means they're like this. So it's a backhanded. And so that person was making the argument. I thought it was plausible, saying what Jesus is getting at here is if someone is like, thinks they're above you and is like that, turn this cheek. So then they have to go like this. Meaning you're saying to them, I'm going to be your equal. Like, no, don't just do that to me. If you want to have a fight, you know, go ahead and, sorry, this thing's going off here. You know, in other words, that this wasn't purely like a groveling, use me as a doormat, but more, I'm asserting myself. I'm saying I'm your equal, but I'm also not swinging back at you. I'm going to go ahead and hit me again, but this time do it like we're, you know, man to man like that. So anyway, I think whether or not that's historically accurate, but the person, you know, making that claim, I thought had a plausible case. The idea being, I think this is very my type of framework where no one's above the law, everyone's equal, things are contractual and so forth, I think lines up with this pretty nicely. Okay, last one here, and then I'll turn over your guys' questions. So this, I saved the best for last. If you get into an argument about anarchism with a Christian, this is the go-to passage. All right, so I'll read this and then give you the brief, you know, my brief response to reaction to it, and then we'll have time for questions. Let every soul be subject. So this is Paul writing this as a letter. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. And then I skipped a verse. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Okay, so let me admit that prima facie, it looks like it'd be hard to call yourself an anarcho-capitalist and believe that Paul is, you know, writing, the Holy Spirit's writing through Paul, right? With this path, that looks like a pretty clear-cut endorsement of the existence of the state. Pay your taxes, you know, do what the authorities say. Okay, so my responses are, forget anarcho-capitalism. Just in general, taken at face value, this means there's no such thing as a bad government on earth, ever, right? If you think that Paul, the prima facie meaning here is what Paul is trying to convey. And so, for example, so I would get into arguments. I used to be at Hillsdale College, and there was a strong, you might call it neoconservative presence there. And so at the time, it was when the Iraq invasion had just happened, and a lot of the students were very much in favor of that. They were big fans of President George W. Bush. And so in an argument on what we're talking about tonight, they deployed this against me. And I said, wait a minute, why is the U.S. trying to remove Saddam Hussein? The only people who should fear Saddam Hussein are evildoers, right? Saddam Hussein is the leader of Iraq because God put him there. So they obviously didn't believe that. Okay, so I wasn't trying to, I wasn't snarky about it. I was, showing them, you guys don't believe the interpretation you're telling me I should believe. That no, unless you think literally, and by the way, there are some people, like, they're such believers in God's sovereignty and whatever, that they actually do just say, everything happens and I'm not going to lose sleep overnight over the existence of, the North Korean regime and whatever, because that's, and that, I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm just saying most people are okay with, at least in principle, people, toppling a totalitarian government, okay? Or even just saying, wow, they're doing some wicked things, they shouldn't be doing that. Okay, so there's that element. But also, even Paul himself was in chains often, okay, for his sharing of the gospel. So it would be weird to think that Paul was honestly saying any earthly ruler, anytime they punish somebody using the police system, is punishing wrongful doing. He knew that that's not true. Okay, so one way people try to reconcile this is this part here. I'm losing the spot. Where they're calling, be unafraid of the authority. Do as good, Okay, so some people reconcile this, with common sense by saying what Paul is saying is if it's a legitimate authority, then they're in power because of God's will and Whereas if somebody, if there's genuinely evil ruler like Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler or, Joseph Stalin, they're actually not a legitimate authority. So that's not the kind of person Paul's referring to here. So that's one way, and that can be, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But then I'm saying that opens the door to, if I'm right in my political views, well then the current system is also illegitimate. It's not as bad as Saddam Hussein's regime, but it's also not squeaky clean in terms of, fidelity to the Ten Commandments. Okay, so that's the way I would handle something like this. Okay, so why don't I stop there and we'll use the remaining time for your guys' questions. He's got a mic and just remember to let him walk up to you.
Do you believe that if we were to go back to natural law, we would see less violent crimes and in society as a whole, possibly?
So the question is, if we went back to natural law, would we see a less violent society? I certainly think, so if by natural law you mean like a system that's adhering more to these principles and it's not just like a group of so-called representatives coming up with all kinds of rules and regulations and everything, yes. And partly it's because I think a lot of things that the government in practice does right now fuels crime. So I think like the drug war spawns a lot of, crime that would not otherwise occur. I think in a lot of areas, the government schools don't do a good job educating kids, and then combine that with minimum wage legislation. So I think the government sets kids up for failure where they don't teach them anything useful, and then they make it so it's hard to get your entry-level job. And so there's like a whole class of people that it's tough for them to even get into the workforce. And then given the drugs are illegal,
It's like, oh, so we're making it so it's hard for you to get skills. You can't even work at a low level to get your foot in the door. We're making it literally illegal for employers to pay you less than this amount. And there's a bunch of drug gangs that you can make a bunch of money on day one if you're willing to break the law and carry a gun. And I think that's, oh, and we'll have a system where if, you know, a woman gets pregnant and she wants to raise the kids without the dad around, we'll pay for that to make that feasible. Okay, so I think that's not a good recipe for, you know, a society that, you know, has a lot of good moral values and whatnot. So it's not blaming anyone in the system. Like we're just saying as a systematic outcome, I think that is not conducive to a law-abiding society. It, oh, sorry, one last thing. The current prison system, I think, is horrible. A lot of people go in, bad stuff happens to them in there that messes them up, and they meet a bunch of hardened criminals. And so it's not surprising that when they get out, they turn back to a life of crime.
So with your anarchist Christian society, would it be something like the Anabaptists, where they don't believe in the power of government? They don't. They have their own communities. That's basically a separate society from mainstream society. They, some of them, most, they don't pay taxes. They don't follow the laws of the government. So would your anarchist society be something like an Anabaptist society, I guess, like that model?
So I mean, I'm vaguely familiar with Anabaptists. I don't know enough to say. Right. Okay. Yes and no. So in terms of like how, given that you are born and grow up in a system that's dominated by a state and the society at large thinks this is a basically legitimate, I mean, people gripe about the government, but they kind of think, yeah, we need a system like this. That, yeah, like what should you do as a Christian with my views? Like I said, I pay taxes partly also because, you know, I for one thing, I think I do more good outside of jail than inside, but also, you know, given that I'm in this system, sort of like Jesus saying, so as not to offend them, go ahead and pay the tax. It's more like that, like I want to go along with the system insofar as I think I can in order to try to show people why I think it's a bad system. So, yeah, I think like that. If you mean, though, if we had the society that I wanted and you didn't have this state and people could do what they want, some groups, yeah, would be very isolationist and kind of just minding their own business. Other ones, though, could, you know, could be very secular and still have a flourishing interconnected network in a full-blown legal code. And there could be, you know, people we call the police showing up and, you know, they might report crimes and things like that and not just say, oh, something bad happened, let's just try to forgive that guy and move on. You know, so they wouldn't necessarily be like that also. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think there'd be a multiplicity of groups based on their value system.
In Genesis 9, it has a command, the Bible, obviously,
yep,
has a commandment to, like, if a man sheds the blood of man, then by man shall his blood be shed. Does your system, like, have any sort of, like, punishment, like, system like that, like, even death penalty? Because it sounds like your system doesn't really have a punishment so much as a last option for someone who might commit murder,
right,
obviously.
Okay, great. Yeah, good question. So, again, for people here, so the Bible certainly lays out a lot of capital punishments for specified crimes. Also, there's also other stuff in parts of the Bible, like, you know, if a child mouths off to his parents, technically, you know, you should kill him. And so clearly, most modern Christians don't think that, you know, pertains to us, and though that was a specific thing for that time period. So in general, and thank you for bringing this up, I meant to make this point, and I keep glossing over it. The way I think it would work, I think it's very intuitive that people think if somebody is first degree convicted murderer, you know, not you're drunk driving and killed somebody, not even necessarily that there's a bar fight and things got out of hand and the guy ended up dead, that, you know, could be manslaughter. But no, like you were mad at some guy, he got a promotion over you at your job and you plotted and you killed him with, you know, malice aforethought. There's a common sense intuitive feeling a lot of people have that if the family wants to, they can kill that guy, that they're not criminals for retaliation. If somebody steals your wallet, you can't kill them. Most people think, no, that's too much. Right. And so I think the system I described, yeah, probably given the current moral system and whatever the people have, the judges that would rise in prominence would probably rule that, yes, you know, they have a lot of careful evidentiary rules in order to make sure we don't convict an innocent person. But given that it's a slam dunk, you know, no, this guy killed somebody and he really planned it out, to say to the you know, the family, like the people who inherit the property and hence the property right of your right to retaliation or retribution, even, that you could kill him if you want to. But I think in practice, most people would, that would get bought out, that the convicted murderer would basically be saying to them, you can kill me, but what if I pay you $1 million? Then can I buy back my right to life? And I think there would be insurance markets and whatever so that, you know, he could actually do that. And that's kind of how I think. So I think to answer your question, yes, the legal code probably would say first degree murderer, you can be, you know, capital punishment. But I think in practice that would get moderated. And I also think that's a very Christian thing. You're right. I know it's disputed, but like the passage where Jesus let him without sin cast the first stone. I know some people say that wasn't really in the early manuscripts. And so maybe people added that. But that mentality, there's a reason I think that got in there, is that that seemed like a thing Jesus would say. And certainly modern Christians do not kill all the people that certain passages in the Old Testament say these people should be, you know, stoned by the community. So that would be my answer.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.